It's 1:30. I'd like to call the meeting to order. The October 7th, 2020 meeting of the TPA Citizen Advisory Committee. Pursuant to the Governor's Executive Order number 20-69, TPA Operating Procedures Section 6.2, and TPA Emergency Order number 2020-04, the Palm Beach TPA is conducting this meeting virtually using the Zoom webinar platform. The TPA selected this platform because it does not require the public to purchase or download any additional software or equipment to attend this meeting. Aside from the Zoom webinar platform that the participants will use to attend remotely, the public will have no discernible difference in their ability to watch the meeting from that of someone physically attending the meeting. Instruction to join this virtual meeting, as well as contact information for a TPA staff member to assist you, are provided in the published meeting agenda. Please note that although some members of the TAC are attending the CAC are attending the meeting in person, committee members will be appearing at today's meeting remotely, either via webcam or telephone. Additionally, scheduled presenters and the CAC liaison will also be appearing via webcam or telephone. Before we begin, I will summarize our public comment procedures for this virtual meeting. Written documents, comments, and questions can be submitted online at the website provided in the agenda. Verbal comments can also be made live through the Zoom webinar platform. When you wish to be recognized, please use the raise hand function within the Zoom platform and then wait to be recognized by the chair and unmuted by the meeting host. Lastly, an in-person visitor may submit a comment card available at the welcome table. First, roll call. Staff, please call the roll so we can establish a quorum.
And I will need you to unmute on your end, but I will also assist you in unmuting. So Terry Brown?
Here.
Mark Bruner?
Here.
Jim Carroll?
Here.
Michelle Damone?
Here.
Greg Fagan is excused. Michael Fitzpatrick?
Here, and I can't see where I, if I want to raise my hand, where is that button?
Let me see. Hold on a second. I'm sorry.
Go down to the bottom and click on participants. You get a column on the extreme right with everybody who's participating. And down at the very far right-hand corner of that is a raise hand button.
Blow my screen. It's not popping up.
If it's an iPad, it's on the upper right.
No, it's generic.
Myron has it correct, except for once you click on the participants.
Oh, I see. I got it.
Go to the bottom right-hand corner.
Yeah. After you click on that, they all pop up. Thank you.
Okay,
I'm sorry. Glenn Harvey?
Here.
Jason Mankoff? Albert Richwagen? And I believe Albert joined. I'm not sure.
Everybody's been... The bottom group has been
I'm here.
Muted.
Thank you. Ryan Rossi.
Here.
Paul Orion.
Here.
And Myra Newman.
Here.
We have a quorum, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Modifications to the agenda. Are there any requested modification to the agenda?
Yes.
Myron?
I would like to add to the agenda old business, the public participation plan. This was discussed at last meeting, and there were some unresolved issues at the last meeting, and I'd like to bring them up and see if they can be resolved.
Okay. How do we do that, Margie?
I'm sorry, I was having problems unmuting. You can make a request to modify. I'm not sure where on the agenda you would like that to fall, Myron. I believe one of your items of concern will be discussed during the liaison report. So if you want it to be the first information item we discuss, we can.
Yes, let's make it the first.
Okay, so
under Robert's Rules of Order, before new business. We operate under Robert's Rules, is that correct?
Correct. So it would be under, you can either make it information item 3A or you can put it all the way at the bottom. I'm just letting you know your request based on your email will be addressed during the liaison report. So if you want to move it to information item 3A, I do need a motion and a second.
Well, it's not, it's old.
How do we make it E?
It's old business, and old business comes before new business. New business is the action items, so it should come before the action items.
Okay. There are no action items.
There are no action items, Myron. So I should have stated that first. I apologize. That's why I'm saying it would be item 3A, because you have no action items on this agenda.
I sit corrected.
Okay, so we'll make it 3A. And that'll be after the liaison's report. Okay?
Yep.
All right. Do we need to get a vote on that?
Yes, I need a motion in a second, please.
All right.
So
whose motion?
That was Mark Brunner. I made the motion to add it to the agenda.
Okay. And who second?
Well, I'll second it.
Thank you.
Myron, okay. All in favor, say aye.
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 Aye. Aye. Any nays? Aye. No nays. Continuing. Motion to approve minutes for September 2, 2020. Motion are there any approved changes to the minutes? If not, can I have a motion to adopt the minutes as presented?
I do have that Michelle raised her hand as well as Myron.
Michelle.
I just wanted to make sure, and I'm looking at the minutes on a small screen, that I had an excused absence. I do know that they received the communication after the fact, sent me an email saying that it would reflect. I just want to make sure it reflects in the minutes.
Yes, Michelle, I did make that change. I will confirm that the version that Glenn signs when we post to our website does reflect that change.
Okay. Is that fine for you, Michelle?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you.
I'd like to, I propose to add a sentence at the beginning of the last chapter, the last paragraph of the section on the public participation plan. It reads as follows. Ms. Booth explained that the TPA periodically prepares a report that includes an analysis of the extent to which the CAC meets the membership distribution requirement as stated in the PPP. She volunteered to provide a copy of the most recent analysis to Dr. Heumann.
Okay.
And I've also shared it on the screen so that all the members are able to view it and make comments if needed.
Okay. Any comments? If no comments, I'd like to have a motion to approve the minutes with the change included. All in favor?
Aye.
I'm sorry, aye. I need a motion, Glenn.
Oh, okay.
I'll make the motion.
Myron, I'll second.
And who's second?
Terry.
I had.
Terry, okay. We have a motion. Any discussion? All in favor, say aye.
Hey.
Hey.
Say nay. No opposed. Passed. Any general public comments received?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Next, comments from the chair and member comments. I don't have any comments. A member have a comment? You. No comments. Moving on to the next item. CAC liaison's report. Jason, will you please review the liaison report?
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Jason Price. I'm the CAC liaison. So first item up is the TPA committee census. The TPA, we developed and completed a survey that we're administering to collect data, diversity data on all of our members. And we've created it and published it, you know, to collect the data. And the survey can be viewed at palmbeachtpa.org/TPA committee census. So we'll distribute this to our committees. We'll collect the information and then we'll follow up with the results. Next is the October National Pedestrian Safety Month. So in October, we're being reminded that everybody is a pedestrian and to take precaution of learning the rules of the road and being cognizant as you're being a pedestrian and moving around. FDOT Transplex webinar series. FDOT is providing information through webinars every Friday in the month of October. And you could find the information at fdot.gov/planning/transplex. And Mobility Week 2020, FDOT is also conducting a statewide celebration of making smart, efficient, and safe transportation choices during Mobility Week, which is October 30th through November 6th. So for more information, you can also go to that website listed here, fdot.gov/projects/Mobility Week. Also, FHWA Lane Repurposing Workshop. The TPA will be hosting this event. This will be on November 2nd, and it'll be a web-based workshop on
November 2nd or 6th?
On the November 6th. Sorry if I said, let's see. The workshop is on November 6th, and registration closes on November 2nd. My apologies for that. Also, there's a FDOT is providing a survey, and they're conducting a survey to find out now people's knowledge of pedestrian and bicycle safety and traffic laws. And they're doing that through a survey that they're hosting online, and we've hosted it. We're providing it as well. And this link, palmbeachtpa.org/FDOT safety survey. So it's open to the public, anyone who wants to take it. It's a nice survey to indicate your knowledge of the laws and some indications of FDOT, you know, to provide some feedback to FDOT in terms of public outreach or public knowledge of traffic laws. Next is American Walks Community Grant Challenge. There's applications for the 2020 Community Challenge Grant are due November 9th of 2020, and grantees can be awarded up to $1,500 in community stipend for projects related to creating healthy, active, and engaged places to live, work, and play. So to find out more information, visit americawalks.org/community-change-grants. And the link is provided here in the liaison report. And next is the Safe Routes to School. Florida DOT is providing the Safe Routes to School grant applications, which are due December 31st. And there's more information at SRTSFL. So safe. Next is our governing board meeting is going to be held next week. Usually there's a week off in between, but it's happening next week, October 15th. And this will be both in person and virtually. So you could attend either way, and you can find more details about the board meeting at palmbeachtpa.org/board. And as a reminder, there's no committee or board meetings in November, and we'll resume regularly scheduled meetings in December, and there'll be CAC will resume on December 2nd. And lastly, our Safe Street Summit will be the host this year. Last year was Broward County MPO, and will be the host this year. It will be virtually, and it will be held January 28th and 29th. And we'll post more information about the event, but the information that is available is at safestreetssummit.org. And that's all I have for the liaison report.
Okay. Where is the October board meeting?
It will be both here in our office or virtually through via Zoom, just like this.
Okay. Are there any public comments on this item?
No, there are not. And I have Myron with his hand raised.
Thank you, Myron.
I just wanted to say thank you for sending it out by email in advance for those of us who are participating remotely. It's helpful to have it on record.
Sure.
Okay. Any other comments on the liaison's report? If not, there are no action items on this agenda. Information items, Myron, 3A, you were the first item.
Thank you. I just to remind everybody, last month we discussed the public participation plan, and one element of the CAC is an important element of that. And the plan lays out the legal requirement for the CAC to have a distribution of interests represented on it, including environmental interests, business interests, freight interests, different sectors of the economy. And I asked whether we actually do reflect that. And Melissa said that she would provide me with the assessment, the analysis that the TPA does periodically in order to get recertified under, I think, both federal and state law. Unfortunately, and we had an exchange of emails after the meeting about that, but I've heard nothing since. I've not seen that analysis. In advance of the meeting, I informed Margie and asked her if she would inform Melissa so that Melissa could present that analysis to us today. And so the other issue that's noted in the minutes of that discussion was that the TPA would review the description of the CAC on the website, which lists the members as nominated by political jurisdiction. And my contention is, my concern is that by listing us as nominated by political jurisdictions, that the representativeness of this committee is political, as opposed to the distributions that distribution of interest it's supposed to incorporate as a matter of law. And this is an important issue to me. So I want to be sure I understand. I would like to hear from the TPA staff about what the most recent analysis of this committee's membership is relative to that distribution. And I'd like to volunteer to work with the TPA staff to develop procedures that in going forward might be useful for helping to assure that future appointments to this committee recognize the need for distributions.
Okay.
Can I ask a question?
Certainly.
The information about the members.
Turn west on Dyer Road toward US 1 North, then turn right onto US 1 North.
It was all part of the nomination process, was it not? I mean, isn't that information already within the public record? And as such, wouldn't it be already readily and easily available to the staff?
Melissa?
Yes, Mr. Chair and everyone.
Can you answer that question and respond to Myron?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, I can. Right.
Good, okay, thank you. Thank you for bringing this up to remind us to take a look. And when we looked at our most recent diversity analysis for the CAC, we realized it was somewhat outdated. We've had change in membership. So we have just recently updated the survey that we use for that. And it was the first item that was covered during Jason's liaison report. And for those of you who have it in print and it's posted online, there's a direct link. And I think it's being emailed to you also. And as you'll see that we're doing the same analysis for all of our committees, but only the CAC, if you check that box, you'll see the difference that CAC members are then being asked to self-identify for as many as apply of various groups, various interest groups, representing the elderly, disabilities, environmental, business issues, and those sorts of things, and specific industries as consistent with our operating procedures. And the demographic questions that we ask are consistent with the terms and the definitions in the US Census. So you're being sent the, or have now been sent, or have available the survey, and we hope everyone will respond to that promptly and let us know if you have any questions on that. But what was most recently done was outdated, so we decided it was a good time to go ahead and get that updated and consistently do that as new members come on to the CAC and the various committees. Regarding the other issue that Myron brought up, we did take a look at the way that the CAC members are identified on our website, and we did make an immediate change to where it says nominated by the city of or county district such and such. So it does identify the entity that made the nomination without appearing that you are an employee or official of that agency that made that appointment. But to be consistent with the way the nominations are made and then ratified by the board, that's the most consistent way to be consistent with the operating procedures. And there is a link to those operating procedures on the page, on the website page for each of the committees. So are there any questions I can answer? Did that address your concerns, Myron?
Well, I haven't seen the survey, census survey that I just learned about it today. So I haven't seen that yet. I think I've been on this with a 1 year off. I think I've been on this committee for about 8 years. I don't remember ever having to do that before. Is this something new?
I know it was done at some point. I wasn't the one doing it. I'm not sure how long it's been, but it was done. Again, those questions were asked of all of our committees, and the specific categories were asked of the CAC members specifically. And I don't recall the timing. I did not do that. But once we have that information on file for you, we assume, you know, that things haven't changed. But we realize we've had some new people who have come on to the CAC as well as our other committees. So it's a good time to take a look and update that. So the hyperlink is in the liaison report that was sent to you. And I think a email link, I believe, is coming directly to all members. And it's very short and easy. And we hope that everyone will complete that for us.
Good. But the most recent certification review did not include anything that was up to date. Is that what you're saying?
It was up to date at the time, but it's out of date now. So we discussed and decided there was not really value to present information that reflected membership that had changed so much since then. So it prompted us to go ahead and do that now.
May I ask that the results of the census survey be presented to the committee at the December meeting?
I don't schedule the meeting. If they're available by then, I'm sure that would be an appropriate time, and Jason would be, I'm sure, happy to consider adding that to the schedule. It certainly is our intent to report back to you all when we've gathered all those responses.
I'll ask the chairman if you
would. So, Myron, if I can interrupt, I'm sorry. I just want to note, to clarify, this is, like Melissa said, we did do this exercise. It's probably been about 2 years. We looked at the process, and we are implementing this process not only for existing members, but it will also be done for new members that wish to join our committees. And the results will be reported to the board members as a part of their appointment request on the agenda. We will provide a report to the committee upon completion of the entire CAC completion, once all, I think we're at 12 members, once all 12 members have completed the census, we can provide that to you. I cannot promise that we can give it to you in December. We will have a report to let you know how many members are still missing from completing the census. But as soon as we have the complete census, we are more than happy to provide it to you.
Okay, I'd like to suggest that you, before the December meeting, you ask the chairman to beat up on the people who haven't responded so that we can get the results by the December meeting. That's what chairmen are for. Right, Glenn?
Yes, we plan to make it a part of our liaison report until we get all responses back, just to make sure it doesn't fall off the radar and we let you know, hey, we got 9 of 12. We're still missing a few people, and we'll send out reminders every month to make sure that everyone's in compliance.
Okay. Well, the other thing I'm interested in, of course, is when new members come on the TPA board, they have the authority to nominate someone to the TAC. And I'm interested in what information is provided to those new board members about the CAC and about the distribution of expertise and interests on the CAC so that, and the interest in providing diversity so that the new board TPA board members are sensitive to that need. I can tell you in my personal experience, That was not done in my case.
So I'd like to respond to that if I could, because when I was a city commissioner and I was on the TPA board, I was at meetings every month in which the executive director would mention what committees there were vacancies, as well as identifying what slots that they were trying to fill. As being a city commissioner, West Palm Beach, I know that Nick reached out to me specifically to see if anybody in the city would sit on this committee to fill a position related to biking, because there's a number of organizations here in West Palm Beach. And so, I mean, there is a process, because I was a member of the TPA and made a recommendation and the TPA took it from there. But it was a specific slot for somebody who had knowledge in that area.
Thank
Is that
you,
right, Paul. Melissa?
Yes, thank you very much. You did an excellent job. Of course, every time a new board member comes onto the board does not necessarily mean that there is a vacancy. If there's a prior appointment from their predecessor who has a term that has not yet expired. So, but every time there is a vacancy, Nick does a very good job of making those announcements to the board, and certainly one-on-one with those board member representatives that do have a vacancy to let them know what the voids are, the criteria that we're trying to fill, where possibly we have a shortcoming. So to address Myron's concern, by the time someone is requesting you be their appointee, they've probably already figured out that you help meet their needs, the needs of the board, and what they personally are looking for in a representative. But thank you very much, Paula. Did an excellent job of explaining the process and how it is brought up to the board members prior to their appointments. But ultimately, their appointments are up to them.
I can only tell you that my experience was different, but that's okay. I mean, you're moving in the right direction, and we'll see what happens when the census survey comes out. We'll see how well we do and what our problems are.
Yeah, you can actually use the link if you choose to today while it's fresh on your mind, the link that's in the liaison's report in the first item, or it will be sent to you very soon, but thank you.
Chair, thank you. I do have Michael Fitzpatrick with his hand raised.
Yes, Michael. You're muted, Michael.
Well, that's the first point is, are we using that raised hand thing? Because I've been using it for about 5 minutes and I don't know. The two things is Myron, proposing a quota system? And secondly, everybody, you know, was appointed by somebody, the representative from their city. Is that, where's that written down and needs to be done that way? Is that part of the, in the charter or bylaws or something, that that's how the...
No, that's not how it's done. And I can tell you what the charter says.
Margie should answer that.
Oh, I'm sorry. Because we went through this conversation a couple of months ago. So.
Margie or Jason, who wants to discuss that?
So to make sure that we're all clear on the same item, what I'm going to do right now is to pull up the operating procedures and show the membership. So it is that each TPA board member is allowed to nominate a CAC member. I'm sorry, if you bear with me while I share my screen. So in the currently adopted operating procedures for the CAC under section 4.2 membership, each TPA governing board member may nominate one CAC member via a written submittal request to the board, which will go on the agenda for consideration and approval by the full TPA governing board. And then it outlines the key areas for groups representation that we have been discussing. There are certain restrictions for what a CAC member, as far as an elected official and so forth, but that's not relevant at this time. But it is each TPA board member, so we can have 21 CAC members that can serve on the CAC. And normally when we have a new board member, just to clarify, when we have a new board member that joins our TPA governing board, Nick does do a one-on-one meet and greet meeting with them. And he does discuss if they have a vacancy or if they do currently have a somebody serving in that place so that they are aware. And he does let them know these are the key areas of the groups of representation that we would like you to meet. As Melissa stated, it is ultimately up to the governing board member who they nominate, but a new part of that process with Nick's one-on-ones will be to provide the census data that we're collecting for all of our committees so that they are aware of the representation of all of our committees.
Okay, thank you, Margie. Does that answer your question, Michael?
And you're muted again, Mike.
Okay. Excuse me, Michael?
Yes, it did.
Thank you very much. Any other questions on this item or comments? If not, let's move on to informational item I-95 at Woolbine Road Project Development and Environmental Study. Jeffrey Easley, would you please present this item?
And I'm sorry to interrupt, Chair. I do have, Michael, you raised your hand again. Is that for after this item or did you have another question?
I tried to unraise it.
Oh, I'm sorry. I will lower your hand for you. Okay.
Okay, Julieta Manso will present the project and we'll answer questions afterwards.
All right, I was muted. Good afternoon, my name is Julieta Manso. I'm with Hanson Professional Services and I'll be presenting the I-95 at Woolbright Road PD&E Study Project Update presentation. We meet today on the call. We have Humberto Arrieta, he's the FDOT project manager, and Jeff Easley, he's the consultant project manager for the project. So the interchange of I-95 at Woolbright Road is located within the city of Boynton Beach in Palm Beach County. The project limits extend along I-95 from just north to just south of the Woolbright Road interchange, and along Woolbright Road from Southwest 18th Street on the west to Southwest 2nd Street on the east. I-95 is a 10-lane divided interstate within the project area, and Woolbright Road is 6 lanes divided west of I-95 and 5 lanes with a two-way left turn lane east of I-95. We also have the South Florida Rail Corridor, CSX, that runs parallel to I-95, and it runs just west of I-95. There was a design build project that was completed in 2019 that widened Woolbright Road over I-95 to provide one additional left turn lane into the I-95 northbound and southbound on-ramp. The purpose of the study, address traffic spillback onto I-95, reduce congestion on I-95 and Wolbry Road within the interchange, improve the interchange operations, and improve safety through the 2045 design year horizon. And the need for the project was established based on system linkage, capacity, transportation demand, model interrelationship, and safety. An existing crash analysis was conducted as part of the study. We look at the last 5-year crash history for I-95 mainline, for the ramps, and for Wolbright Road within the project limits. And based on the results of the crash data, we determined that most of the crashes are associated with heavy congestion along the 3 segments of the project, being the rear end collisions the most predominant crash type. On this slide, we show the existing year traffic conditions. The boxes on the top shows the lane configuration at each of the interchanges in intersections that we evaluated, which includes Southwest A Street intersection, the southbound ramp terminal intersections, and the northbound terminal intersections. On the aerial, we show the delay and level of service for each of these intersections. The dot boxes, which in this case are green, are representing the AM peak values, and the bottom boxes, which are in yellow, represent the PM values. So for the existing analysis, we have level service Cs in the AM peaks at all 3 intersections, and level service D at all 3 intersections. Based on the no action or no build analysis for the 2045 year conditions, the traffic projections at the 3 intersections will deteriorate by the year 2045. So we level service F and E at Southwest A Street, and levels of service D and E at the ramp terminals with I-95. As part of the alternatives analysis evaluation, we evaluated the no action alternative, and we also look at 3 build alternatives. As part of the build alternative, we had alternative 1 was maximizing the existing tight diamond interchange configuration that we have there today. We also looked at a diverging diamond interchange, and alternative 3 was a single point urban interchange. We presented all of these alternatives at our alternatives public workshop, which was conducted in July 22nd. We also had a virtual open house available on the project website for people to go in and review the project and the alternatives. So after we had the public workshop and based on the evaluation of the 3 build alternatives, we have selected a preferred alternative, which is alternative 1, which includes maximizing the existing tight diamond interchange configuration. So what you see here on the screen now, it's the tight diamond interchange, which is our preferred alternative. I know it's a little hard to look at because it looks very small, but we also have a concept that we can put on display after the PowerPoint so we can look closer at some of the improvements. But just to give you an overview of what the improvements include, with this alternative, we are widening Wolbry Road over I-95 to provide one additional through lane in each direction. As part of the widening, we're also widening the bridge over the South Florida Rail Corridor to accommodate for the additional widening. We're widening the northbound and the southbound off-ramps to provide one additional left turn lane. Right now, there's only 2 left turn lanes at the ramp terminal, so we'll provide triple lefts. We are making improvements at the Southwest A Street intersection. And with those improvements, we are adding one additional westbound through lane through the intersection. We are adding one additional left turn lane on the eastbound and westbound direction to accommodate for double lefts. Right now, it's only 1 left turn lane. And based on those improvements, we also need to widen the bridge over the E4 canal to accommodate for those improvements. We are, with this alternative, extending the bicycle lanes that right now end after the I-95 interchange. We're extending those all the way to Southwest 18th Street. So I know it's very hard to see on this graphic, but we can look at it closer after we go over the PowerPoint presentation. In this slide, we show the bridge over the I-95 and the bridge over the South Florida Rail Corridor. As I mentioned before, these two bridges were widened as part of the design build that was completed in 2019. So with this improvement, we have determined that based on the structural analysis of these two bridges, we can still widen the bridges now on the other side, which is the south side. So this is just a representation of the additional widening that will have to be done on these two bridges. As you can see on the graphic, it's the representation on the right side of the graphics. And this typical section shows the widening of the bridge over the E4 canal. Currently, there is an existing pedestrian bridge that runs on the north side of Woolbright Road on a separate structure. With this widening, we will incorporate a new sidewalk as part of the widening for this bridge. So we will maintain that sidewalk continuity. The traffic analysis for the 2045 for the preferred alternative is shown on this slide. And as you can see, the proposed improvements will improve the operation at all three intersections, bringing the level of service at the Southwest A Street intersection to E in the AM and D on the PM, and also bringing up the levels of services at the ramp terminal intersections with C on the AM and PM at the southbound ramp terminal, and levels of service C and D at the northbound ramp terminal intersections. In this picture, we show right-of-way impacts associated with the improvements at the Southwest A Street intersection. We have determined that there's approximately 2,000 square feet of right-of-way that will be needed to accommodate for the widening that is being done at the intersection. There's no impacts to any buildings or any parking spaces as part of these right-of-way impacts. As I just mentioned, only one business property. As part of right-of-way, there's no relocations anticipated or any business damages for that right-of-way impact. And the cost estimate, we have an estimated construction cost of $12 million, right-of-way acquisition $1.5 million, for a total cost estimate of about $17 million for the project. We started this project at the end of 2018. We had an agency and public kickoff meeting back in May in 2019. As I mentioned, we had our public alternatives public workshop in July 2020. We have also met with the city of Boynton Beach twice. We met with them before the public kickoff meeting and before the ALTS workshop. We also met with the TPA, with Andrew and Nick before the ALTS workshop, just to present the alternatives that we were gonna show to the public. And right now we're here just to present the updates of our recommendation and our preferred alternative as part of the project. When we started the project, the class of action for the PD&E was a categorical exclusion type 2. And after selection of our preferred alternative, and given that we're maximizing the existing interchange without any major improvements, the project is being reclassified as a categorical exclusion type 1. So what this means, the project's still moving forward to the design phase, but we do not require to have a public hearing as part of the project. So this will help us conclude the PD&E faster. We will wrap up the project and move it on to the design phase, and design is scheduled to begin early next year. To just to keep an update with the public, we would be preparing a newsletter and mailing it out to all of our mail out distribution just to inform the public that we are already selecting a preferred alternative and the project will be moving on to the design phase. So with that, I can open up for any questions, and we can also have the concept on the screen so we can go over any comments.
Okay, before we start the discussion, are there any public comments on this issue?
No, Mr. Chair. And I have Mike Fitzpatrick followed by Terry.
Michael?
The new configuration is a tight diamond. Is the current configuration also a tight diamond?
Yes.
So it's just beefing up what's there now.
Yeah, we're maximizing the existing configuration, correct.
Okay, that's all.
Terry?
Yes, I guess I'm going back a couple of years. when I thought that we were presented with a proposal, I don't know if it's in tandem with this project or separate, where you were going to widen the lanes all the way down to Seacrest on the south side of Woolbright, because you can't widen where the cemetery is, and you were going to add lanes at Seacrest. You know, that's where there's a lot of traffic backup going over to the hospital in Boynton. Everybody wants to turn right. So whatever happened to that portion of the project?
Well, this project started out, I mean, that concept that you're referring to was part of the concept development report that preceded the PD&E study. And they looked at Woolbright Road between Seacrest and 8th, and they may have went to 18th, and also the interchange. And they developed, as part of that study, improvements along Woolbright, but they prioritized those. I mean, that plan really included the top priority ones, the interchange improvements, and anything that affects the interchange. And any improvements at Seacrest were really identified by others, because, you know, Woolbright is a county road and Seacrest is a county road. And this project really was to focus on the interchange.
Seacrest is a county road?
Seacrest is a county road. And so that intersection, when we had our kickoff meeting, we had a representative from Palm Beach County, and I forget the gentleman's name. And he mentioned to us that they had a safety improvement planned at Seacrest. But this project started, you know, that was looked at, and it was determined that we would look at the interchange, move out from the interchange as far as anything that affects the interchange or the interchange effects. And Seacrest is located far enough away that really what happens at Seacrest does not affect the interchange, and what happens at the interchange does not affect Seacrest. Now, 8th Street is close enough that the westbound traffic.
8th Street's on the west side, yeah. Mainly discussing what happens on the east side, where people are going to the hospital, to Bethesda Hospital on the right. It's just going to be more traffic in that area. If you're loading more traffic onto Woolbright towards Seacrest, you're going to have more traffic jammed up there. I think that was a theory of widening the lanes all the way down to Seacrest. In fact, it goes all the way down to US-1. I mean, you can wait now through a couple during the winter months, a couple three light changes before you can get to US-1. So it's just a big problem. I thought that you're saying that they removed that from consideration, but this is part of the same project.
Well, that was part of the planning study, and the planning study took it to Seacrest. But, you know, it prioritized those projects as really what needed to be considered as part of this study and what needed to be considered as part of other studies.
Is that primarily because of COVID funding? Funding has been affected by COVID? And you're trying to just tighten up the projects that are absolutely necessary and not enhance the roadways near them?
No, that has nothing to do with it. This decision was based on early in the project. We made a decision that the improvements as part of this project would be at the intersections that affect the interchange and what the interchange affects. And Seacrest is outside of that zone. So that's the improvements of this project focus on.
Well, they're widening the exit lanes. It means there's going to be more traffic going down to Seacrest.
Terry, this is
more volume.
Can you hear me? Hello.
I'm talking. Is there someone interrupting?
No.
I'm trying to answer
your question, person.
This is Humberto Arrieta. I'm the FDOT project manager for this project. I just want to clarify one thing in regards to what you were discussing right now. It is our policy to extend the limits of these projects along the interchanges, just as far as we need to go to improve the operations of the interchange. It's not it's not just this one in particular. It's a policy that we have for all of them.
Okay.
I just wanted to clarify that. Sorry.
I appreciate the comments, and I just wanted to be sure I understood why that other part, I guess you were saying it was never included, actually. It was just part of a scope of work study. Thank you.
Glenn, I did mute you, so you'll need to unmute on your end. I don't see any other hands raised.
Any other comments? If not, then we'll move on to Palm Beach County Traffic System Information. Would Moa Turk please present?
All right. Good afternoon. This is Rasa Mawad. Even though it says Moa Turk, Mo could not attend, so I'm here on his behalf to present this section.
Thank you.
All right, so I'm going to share some information regarding Palm Beach County's traffic signal system. I'm going to give you an overview on some of the initiatives we have taken recently in the past few years. All right, so this is an outline of the presentation. I'm going to generally highlight the department that we belong to, which is Engineering Public Works. I'm going to zoom in and talk a little bit about the traffic division. And then I'm going to get into the traffic signal system, some of the specifics and the devices that we use. Finally, I'm going to go over the active arterial management and the flashing yellow arrow initiatives that we've taken in recent years. The Engineering Public Works Department, it's one of the primary departments at Palm Beach County. It includes six primary functions that you see over here and many happy faces in the picture there. You got major sections like the roadway production division that sets the five-year road program. You have construction coordination that oversees construction within infrastructure improvements within public right-of-way. You have land development, oversees just about any right-of-way permit application that comes in, as well as the land development review process. And then we belong here in traffic, and I'll zoom in on traffic. And it's a full-service traffic division. I've been here a couple of years, and it certainly has all the tools that are needed to for a well-run traffic division. We oversee a large traffic signal system. Primarily, we're broken into two sections. One is the called operations. It pretty much the boots on the ground, the folks that go out and maintain signs, pavement markings, and the traffic signal system. And then we have the engineering side that handles the planning, the design, growth management, some special projects and programs like the roadside vendor program, traffic calming, street lighting, and so forth. As for signal systems and primarily this traffic management center that we have here, these are just key milestones over the past 13, 14 years. The traffic management center was built in 2007 using federal and state funds. It's a joint facility between the state and the county. The state utilizes it to oversee the freeway system, even though a good portion of that is run from the Broward Center that is very similar to the setup here. And then the county is responsible or utilizes the center for the arterial system. One of the key years here at the county was 2012 when the concept of a living lab, or which later became the active arterial program here, the acronym is AM in 2013, is to get to that proactive level. We have a traffic management center. We have a lot of communication to these signals. So the idea was to have more intervention in real time with the traffic signal system. And that's the whole concept of active arterial management is pretty much proactive management of signals in real time when you do have these tools and capabilities. In 2015, we started deploying some of the adaptive traffic control systems. In 2016, from the incident management through the active arterial management that we do, we started putting these incidents into the state's 5-1-1 system so that they're logged and managed. And finally, the active arterial management program has been very successful to where we got with the state and expanded it to cover more corridors. As far as the signal system goes, and the elements and the ITS, intelligent transportation system devices that we utilize on a daily basis to manage the signal system, we do have the total number of traffic signals or signalized intersections is about 1,100 in the county, 850 of which are online, meaning we can see them second by second. They communicate over fiber back to a central location here, the Traffic Management Center. And then we have a few layers of ITS or Intelligent Transportation System equipment or devices to help us manage the system, like CCTV cameras. These are the dome-looking cameras that you can pan, tilt, zoom. And then we have some video detection devices, or VDS here is the acronym. Too many acronyms, I know that. But these are stationary. They're meant to detect vehicles at the intersection in lieu of the traditional loop systems that you would see in the pavement on every approach. But they also give us viewing capability. Bluetooth or Bluetooth devices readers, they're pretty much travel time and speed detectors. They were a lot more popular 10 years ago. They're kind of losing their thunder simply because everybody carries a smartphone and smartphones are tracked. And there are all these entities that give you travel time and speed based on where your smartphone is. And then one of the biggest investments that the county did, which enabled us to do all these extra activities, is the fiber. Fiber is how we communicate to all these signals, which is about 850 of them. County invested early and extensively in that arena. And one thing we see with some of the agencies that did not go that route is that the way to catch up is pay a monthly fee, just like a phone bill, to have these signals communicate so you can interact with these signals and get key measures and modify the timing in real time. As for the successful active arterial management, it's again funded by the state, and it's a joint agreement between the county and the state. To sum it up, it's really just taking it to a proactive level. We have second by second data to the traffic signals. We get key alarms from the system that tell us what's happening. So the program really took a few major corridors back in 2013 and staffed the Traffic Management Center to have eyes on the system for about 12 hours a day between 7 and 7 to manage items that we would have otherwise not been able to. If you look, I like this chart here, the sources, the Federal Highway Administration, and it's the sources of congestion. It's an older chart, but quite a bit of these elements, if you do not do that active management, then you're not really helping. Weather, work zones, incidents is a big one, and then the reoccurring bottlenecks. In peak hours, we are intervening constantly with the system to try to push traffic one way or the other. So an incident detection was a key element there. A crash, shuts down two lanes. We're able to kind of interact and intervene with the active system and push timing that would help the blocked approach or approaches, if you will. And again, in 2019, we talked to FDOT and successfully expanded because of its success. The program to cover, it covers now, it went up from 90 signals covered to about 240. And we expect in the future, we'll continue to expand it down the road. Just a snapshot of what a zoomed in level, what the operator sees or a signal timing engineers in the TMC or Traffic Management Center see is you have some analysis tools. I'm looking at the picture here to the left. And then you have the viewing capability through the cameras, whether it's the pan, tilt, zoom, or some of the stationary cameras. That ATMS.now is the central software that we use to manage the signal system. And then obviously you constantly monitor and adjust based on the real-time traffic conditions. And it's measurable. The little report here at the bottom left is a monthly report that's produced to see how many incidents were managed, what's the travel time reliability for each of these corridors. And one of the recent initiatives that we've taken is the flashing yellow arrow. I'm sure many of you have seen it statewide, nationwide. It's been implemented since the early 2000s and heavily tested. And 2009 is when it became a standard through the Federal Highway Administration's manual on uniform traffic control devices. If you're making a left, to sum it up, if you're making a left from a left turn lane, a single left turn lane, and you make it now when you have a green ball, the flashing yellow arrow pretty much replaces that green ball where you have to yield the right of way to oncoming traffic as well as the pedestrians, the conflicting pedestrian movement. So it has a lot of benefits, safety and capacity as well. We started at the end of 2019, picked 8 intersections along Congress Avenue in the Boynton Beach Mall area. And we picked this area because it had a good mix for that initial push or project that we wanted to put these flashing yellow arrows at. Some intersections have good decent pedestrian activity to where we can see how effective that might be and utilize the settings that would help enhance safety. And it has a good number of signals and a coordinated system where the benefits of the capacity benefits and the synchronization benefits can be realized. In general, the benefits when it comes down to capacity and safety, from a capacity standpoint, it simply allows for more opportunities for the left turns to proceed or advance, simply because the lefts now have their own indication. They're no longer tied to the adjacent through lane. So more opportunities from a setup standpoint, it gives us more flexibility throughout the day to shut off that flashing yellow arrow when it's high volume, high risk, and then when it's lower volume, lower risk, and there's opportunities, we can turn it on, and it helps in synchronization, how the signals are tied and the platoons are pushed one way or the other. From a safety standpoint, primarily, a flashing yellow arrow has been thoroughly studied and proven that it's a more cautionary signal than a green circular ball, which many folks sometimes just try to get the sense that it's a go. And then for pedestrians, that's a key element because it helps us in two ways, really, with pedestrians. And I'm talking about when you're making a left onto a crosswalk and you're supposed to yield the right of way to not only the oncoming traffic, but these conflicting pedestrians. First, the flashing yellow arrow is a more cautionary signal than a circular green indication. And a second level where there's high conflicting pedestrian numbers, the setup and the programming allows us to set it up to where if there is a call or someone pushes the button in that crosswalk, we can skip that portion of the signal, the permissive, the flashing yellow altogether for that one cycle to protect the pedestrian. And finally, the federal highway over extensive deployments established, the flashing yellow arrow reduces crashes. There's a crash modification factor, I think, of about 14 to 15%. Our next steps when it comes down to the flashing yellow arrow, essentially it's our standard. Any new installations, we will install flashing yellow arrows. Any new signal construction, we'll include that. Any signal modification that we're doing, we'll include that. That's kind of the near future. Long-term, we are seeking funding for both the state highway system as well as the rest of the county corridors to implement on a county-wide basis. And this sums it up. One thing I wanted to mention is over the past year or so, our website has gone through multiple enhancements. And under the Public Works Traffic Division, you should be able to see this little section that gives you emails and phone numbers to contact us for the different areas that we have. And this wraps it up. Thank you. I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Okay. Before we have a committee discussion, staff, are there any public comments on this issue?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Committee chair members have any comments? Thank you.
I have Myron with his hand raised.
Oh, I didn't see that. Myron?
A couple of months ago, at a meeting of something called the North County Neighborhood Coalition, in discussion of the proposed new intersection at North Lake Boulevard and Beeline Highway, SR 710. The FDOT representative said that the signals were going to be set in such a way that freight traffic coming southeast on Beeline Highway could have a priority for moving through the intersection without stopping. And I'm wondering, subsequently, about a 2 months later, a representative said that they dropped that proposal. I was wondering how that would actually work if they actually decided to go through with that. How do you give truck traffic priority for green lights? I would think if you could do that, you'd do that for emergency vehicles before you do that for truck traffic.
And yes, that was the initial concept. We believe that the state wanted to do, and the funding was, I think, through the, you know, the freight system, and it was geared to include freight priority. And when we looked at it, we do have a priority for emergency vehicles because we have a system active at a good 600 signals for our fire rescue department. That's a priority. We obviously have the preemption the for railroad, and there's one there. There's a railroad crossing. So in our opinion, freight should not get priority. And we discussed this with FDOT, and our understanding is that is now taken away from the plan. There will be a project there to enhance connectivity and connected signal applications, but it should not include freight priority.
Thank you.
Okay. Any other raised hand, Margie?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Next, we're going to move on to the Southeast Florida Transportation Council, SEFTC 2045 Regional Transportation Plan. Summary. Jessica Jocelyn, please.
Yes, thank you. Good afternoon, everyone. So as shared, I'm Jessica Jocelyn with Kittleson Associates, and I am the project manager that led the development of the Southeast Florida Regional Transportation Plan this cycle, the 2045 cycle. This project actually began 2018, so I could have easily given, you know, a 3-hour presentation on all the great work the region's been doing, but I'm going to try to do this in about 10 minutes and talk about the 3 years worth of effort. Just a teaser, this presentation contains new policies that the region intends to explore moving to Tallahassee with some of these ideas, and we are bringing this presentation to your board on the 15th, I believe it is, of this month. So today it's just an information item. We're gathering feedback and support on these policies. And again, the action item will go through your board. And I'll dive into more detail now behind that in the presentation. So before getting though into detail on the regional transportation plan, some of you may not be aware of the regional coordination we do throughout Southeast Florida. And the regional coordination being done is actually a formal agreement across the three MPOs, including your transportation planning agency, but also Broward Metropolitan Planning Organization, and then our partners to the very south, the Miami-Dade Transportation Planning Organization. And this formal partnership began in 2005 through a memorandum of understanding, and each of these MPOs, including yourself, are a equal contributing partner to help ensure that we're planning across the three counties and that we're as consistent and compatible as possible to move the 6.1 million people that we have right now. So now jumping back into the regional plan, I wanted to walk through some of the elements of the plan so that you're aware of the different details and analysis that was conducted. So what you see here on this slide is a snapshot of what we define as regional. So this is actually a very data-driven objective exercise where the Technical Advisory Committee, RTAC, that supports the council, works together to figure out, you know, what would we call regional in terms of facilities? And really what it ended up being are your facilities that carry the most amount of people and goods. So really your principal arterials, the strategic intermodal system that the state has identified, and a few facilities in between. Also, I wanted to note that rail lines is part of the regional network. So any active rail line, we've all agreed that that's very important to moving people and goods through the region. And why defining regional is important, you might be asking yourself. It's important because there is a small pot of money that's directly attached to something being regional on this map. So it's the Transportation Regional Incentive Program, specifically, if you're interested. And again, if a facility is not on this regional network, it is not eligible for that funding. So that's why this becomes pretty important. So once our group in the region defined what is considered a regional facility, we then dove into identifying our goals across the three county region. And they are very similar to what you have in your long range transportation plan. So here you see there are four goals, being a multimodal system with compatible land use, having health as an element in how we plan our transportation system, keeping things environmentally friendly and also safe, of course, for all users, how we can expedite our transportation projects to keep the economy thriving as much as possible. And then the last goal, of course, being that we plan in an equitable way and that what we are doing is desired and supported by the public. And we see kind of how these collectively come together to make our future a sustainable one and ideally a higher quality of life. And in the bottom left-hand corner here, you see transit funding and land use. And these were three elements when looking at the goals that we really wanted to zero in on this regional transportation plan, noting that as we grow to be about 7.5 million people in the region, we really need to think of more options and create a system and structure from a funding and land use perspective that supports being able to move in a multimodal fashion. So once the goals were identified, we collectively worked together to identify the issues, very similar to how the TPA does in their long-range transportation plan. So I'm just going to briefly go through some of the main challenges or obstacles that we identified that we would then later on go to solve and analyze some strategies for. So the first is the growing population. I'm sure you're aware and been hearing through all of the studies that we're rapidly growing. We're showing about 1,000 people a week are planned to move to South Florida across the three counties, not just Palm Beach County, over the next 25 years. So that was something that we as a region wanted to tackle head on. The middle category, mismatched investments. So we actually did across the three county region an analysis in the 2040 regional plan, where we found that 14% of our funds were going towards transit projects. Whereas in the unfunded project list, about 86 to 98% of the high to medium high projects were transit. So we actually were finding a mismatch in what we wanted to fund versus what we could based on the restrictions of the funding. And then the last category that we found as kind of a barrier or challenge to overcome as a region is limited access. And by that we mean we're developing in a way that is not sustainable in the long term to accommodate the 7.5 million people that we're expecting to come to South Florida. So next we went ahead and to tackle those challenges, we took on a technical analysis called scenario planning, if you're not familiar. And within scenario planning, it's a data-driven process where using different pieces of data, technical professionals in the region across various agencies, including the state, county, and MPOs, tested different what-if scenarios. So the data that we played with were, as you see on the left, looking at different high-capacity transit needs. So what type of premium transit investments could we make based on data, and where would those transit lines go? And then the second element we looked at was what we call growth and development. So we tested if we kept the land use and densities as they are today and forecast to be as they are today, would that generate a multimodal option type of system? Would people use a different type of system? And then last we tested how much would something like this cost if we were to expand our multimodal system? And do we have the money to afford it today, or do we need to look at things differently? So those elements translated into three scenarios that you see on the right. Scenario one is our status quo scenario. So if we kept doing everything that we've been doing, what would that look like with 7.5 million people? Scenario two, we call the regional transit scenario. So we asked ourselves, if we had the money to do so, and we could have flexibility in our funding programs, what type of multimodal system would we want to build? And there we ended up with the result in Palm Beach County being your 561 plan, essentially, from the transit side of things. So we tested what that 561 plan would look like when implemented with other transit projects in the region. And then the third scenario was a complement of the regional transit scenario, but in addition to looking at adding and expanding a premium transit system, it also explored and tested reassigning how we develop our land. And specifically, the group looked at testing if 75% of new growth, so not suggesting people move that are already here and redesign their lifestyle, but for new growth coming in, that we would recommend planning that with the transportation system and putting 75% of new growth around the transit lines. So what did we find when we tested this scenario? And what we found really matched with what we suspected, but it was nice to be able to have the numbers behind it. So when you compare our status quo, what we're doing today, to the most progressive of the three scenarios, scenario three, growth and development, we actually found using transportation models that ridership increased by 350%. And even more importantly than just looking at how many people are on a bus, access really expanded. So walkable access to high capacity transit from home, where people maybe can get rid of their cars, save money, or if they don't have a car today and can't afford a car, we're actually increasing access from 5 to 35% under this what if scenario. And then in terms of jobs, walkable access to jobs from this high capacity transit system went from 10% under status quo, jumping to 50%. So quite drastic changes in this what if future condition that we assessed in this exercise. And furthermore, we can conclude that with this multimodal system where people are driving, using the buses, they also will be walking and biking more because of the way this growth and development scenario allocated how we develop land in the future. So once we concluded with the exercise of the what if scenarios, we had to come back and look at, okay, these things haven't changed yet. So based on the game we're playing in right now, if you will, or the pieces in the structure that we have right now, this is the breakdown of the cost feasible plans across the three MPOs. And you see 76% went to roadway and freight, which the group agreed is still very important. That's going to be critical to moving people. But you see transit went from 14% to 18%. So we did see a jump in this cycle across the region with moving more towards multimodal focused investments. you see 4% in complete streets and then 2% in systems management and operations, which is similar to the presentation Rossum gave, where we're investing more into our signal system. And I can't conclude on this presentation without discussing all the great strides we are making towards achieving that vision of seamlessly moving 7.5 million people on a safe multimodal system throughout the region. So here's just a snapshot of some of those different activities the transportation profession has taken on through committees such as yours and with elected officials. So there's a lot of momentum behind getting ready for a 21st century transportation system in an urbanized area such as Southeast Florida. But as I alluded to in the introduction, we are moving forward with policy recommendations to take to the Secretary of the Department of Transportation, as well as state representatives based on the findings of this study. So here I'm gonna walk through what those policies are, and then I'm gonna open it up for a discussion if there's any comments, but we are going to be going out and seeking support in general for these policies. So the first policy based on the testing we did is regional transit with supporting infrastructure is key to support growth and long-term mobility. So within this policy, we're just recognizing, again, to move those 7.5 million people, we really need to have options, and it's needed to move that amount of people. And it was very important that the region also include in this policy how important it is to still accommodate the demand for auto travel. That people driving is not going to go away. It's still very much needed and a part of our community's needs. But we also just recognize in complementing that, we would like to still move forward with having the ability to have other options. And then lastly, and this one came directly from the Palm Beach TPA board representation on the council, is that a safe first last mile system is also strategic for having this multimodal vision be successful. The next policy is the land use component, where complementary land use is essential. So the region also recognized that without changing land use development to a more transit-friendly one, that it may not be as successful. You can't just build the transit and people go ride it. So we wanted to recognize that in this policy. And again, here we also recognize that short walk bike trips also are generated with this type of complementary land use in mind. The third of the four policies is increased flexibility within funding programs is crucial. So here we, as I was saying before, we went through an exercise of assessing what type of funding. And what we found in that is that the state funding programs are too restrictive and too tied to one type of solution. So this policy is looking to kind of loosen that up a bit. And we did different testing where about 30 to 50% of creating flexibility in state programs could generate almost $9 billion to help go towards the transit system while still maintaining about $13 billion for highway capacity and congestion issues. So again, just in this sub-bullets, creating flexibility within those state funding structures. And we wanted to highlight that having a successfully connected, safe, convenient transit system would have a greater impact on moving the additional 1.4 million people that are anticipated to move to Florida or South Florida. And then last, again, the region wanted to highlight how important it is with the funds we have to continue to operate and maintain the strong highway system that's there today, which is moving a majority of our traffic. And then the last policy is new revenue sources are necessary. So the group did an exercise and found that although there is maybe potential to use our money that we have today differently, that there would still be a need for a new revenue source. And actually during the development of this plan, Broward County passed a surtax. So that was helpful for their county to help go towards this vision. But of course, that's just one of three counties. And I think there's still opportunity should the individual counties and local folks want to go forward with new revenue sources, that that would be necessary to achieve this vision in its entirety. So with that, those are the policies that, again, the region will be moving forward, going to state representatives and the secretary of the Department of Transportation. This final slide, I appreciate your time as I went through all that. This final slide is a sneak peek of a moveFloridaForward.com website that we are working on that's going to be interactive, where there's going to be a call for action on this website, where all the groups we're going to outside the MPOs, we're going to be asking for support through resolutions or letters of support should they desire to do so, so that that can further complement the elected officials going to Tallahassee in the near term. So with that, I'm happy to open it up for questions or comments.
Thank you. Are there staff, are there any public comments on this issue?
No. Oh, I was going to say no, Mr. Chair, but I do have a public comment. I have Kevin, and I'm sorry if I mispronounced your last name, Cairo, with his hand raised. Kevin, you should be able, I'm sorry, I think I muted you. You should be able to unmute on your end, and then you will have 3 minutes.
Hi. So my name is Kevin Cairo. I live in Boynton Beach. I guess I read in the meeting that I should list my address as well. So I'm at 9680 Lago Drive, 33472. I have recently been reading through a lot of these TPA documents, and was reading through the RTP, and I have generally found it really interesting, and I think there's a lot of really cool and just super helpful analysis in there. I am generally kind of curious, you know, like in one of the overall RTP, there's a set of charts that projects like mode choice at 2045 and shows very, very little shift. Like for instance, driving alone shifting 2% in Miami-Dade and 1% in Palm Beach County, and no shifts in transit or motorized, non-motorized and school bus mode share. And, you know, I find a lot of this stuff kind of confusing to like make sense of. So, because it sounds like, you know, the verbiage is very kind of, it sounds quite aspirational, and I get excited about it, but then data like this kind of hampers my expectations. And I wonder if you could speak to like whether, you know, as a member of the public, if I look forward to 2045, I can expect that these goals shift and become more aggressive, or if this is kind of just the nature of the beast of trying to develop the transit systems in a region that is so car dependent and, you know, habituated to it.
Margie, am I able to respond right away?
Please.
Yeah, that's all for me.
Thank you. Kevin, I first appreciate you reading that 200-page document or flipping through it, and the compliments. Definitely appreciate that positive feedback. And you definitely saw what we saw as well. So the tools that we have available to us to really assess this what-if scenario, should these different elements align, aren't perfect. And I know folks aren't expecting them to be perfect, but I think when you're looking at such drastic changes, the models we use do still, to some extent, if not completely, expect the behavior today to be maintained. So even if we move land use in the model, if we build different transportation projects in the model, human behavior is hard to change in the model. So although those numbers weren't as exciting or progressive as I would have hoped, we did suspect that just based on other regions doing this, and rather than focusing on the black box model, look at how people actually behaved in other cities and regions like South Florida, we were very positive that there would be better numbers than what the model showed and that you read in the report. So we are hopeful it'll be much better than what you saw because of the limitations in the model.
So just so you know, Jess, I did disable him from talking because we were at we're close to our 3 minutes for him. Chair, I don't have any committee members with their hands raised that I can see on my end.
Okay. Anybody have any items for this on this item?
I can't raise my hand either, Margie. It's Paula. Just to Kevin, he's interested in exploring and is interested in learning more on this report provided by our leader. There is a workshop, trying to find it. Maybe you can help me. Yes, there's a workshop on land use and transportation planning, and they have a lot of high level experts, and it might be a great opportunity to get into some of the weeds as to, you know, why it's so difficult to implement these mode shifts. Just for information purposes.
Okay. Thank you, Paula. Kevin, is that something of interest of you?
Chair, like I said, I did mute him, but I will allow him to speak again. So Kevin, you'll need to unmute on your side.
Yeah, thank you. I actually did already sign up for some workshops, I think through the Thousand Friends of Florida website. So I'll look for this one and see if it's the same one or if it's a different one. Where can I find it?
It's okay, on the liaison report. It's a link to, I think it's planning, third item, Transplic web series.
Okay. I'll seek it out, but thank you. I appreciate it. And thanks for letting me respond.
Thank you very much. Okay. Any other comments on this, on the issue? If not, we'll move on to updates to local initiatives and transportation alternatives program guidelines and scoring system. Jason, would you please present?
Yes. Good afternoon, everyone. I'm going to present the local initiatives and transportation alternatives guidelines and scoring system and some of the brief updates for this year's grant cycle. To begin, I'll just go over an overview of the local initiative program. It is a five-year time horizon. The maximum amount to apply for a project is $5 million. The annual amount provided each year is $20 million. And this grant program predominantly funds low-cost regional non-regionally significant projects that include complete streets, transit capital like electric buses, non-motorized facilities like bike and pedestrian facilities, and freight infrastructure. For this program, if an applicant is awarded funds through this application cycle, they'll have design funds that will be available in 2024, and then their construction funds will be available in 2026. So it's about a five-year time horizon. The other program is the Transportation Alternatives Program, and that is slightly different. It's a smaller pot of funds. It's an annual amount of $3.1 million annually, and the maximum amount to request per project is approximately $1 million. And the minimum is $250,000. So it's a smaller pot, but you can still get quite a few things done with this type of funding. And it's geared towards more locally driven projects on local roads. And it includes what we've seen as sidewalks, bicycle facilities, ped and bicycle signals, lighting, and just safe infrastructure that provides safety to bikes, pedestrians, and automobile. So with this program, since it's a three-year program, if you were to be awarded this cycle, then your design funds would start in 2022 and the construction funds would be available in 2024. And this program has a shorter time frame, but it's also restricted to LAP certified agencies, and LAP is local local assistance program. It's basically the program where locals deliver their own project. It's not driven by FDOT, so they implement it on their behalf, or the county could deliver it for them. So those are the two programs. And this is I just wanted to point out some of the projects that were built through local initiatives and transportation alternatives. We put together a few slides just to illustrate some of the projects. So this is Bing's Point Pathway in Wellington. This was recently constructed. And then Palmetto Park Road shared use path in Boca Raton. And we have the Fifth Avenue Greenway and Lake Worth Beach. That came out very nice, as you can see by the picture. And there's a couple bridge projects underway right now, at Eau Claire Ranch Road Bridge and the Seminole Drive Bridge. So those bridges will be replaced and there'll be bicycle and pedestrian facilities included on the newer structures. Now, some of these are the updated dates for this year's program. The program kickoff will be on October 15th. That'll be when the two programs go before the TPA board next week, and they'll approve the programs and we'll kick off the program. The first item is the first real kickoff is the program workshop on October 27th in a couple weeks. And the program workshop is where we invite all participants that are considering applying, both any city officials, anyone interested in applying comes to the is welcome to the workshop. It's going to be both virtually and a hybrid of here in the office. So we'll present in the office. It'll be recorded and streamed live and recorded. And also FDOT will be in attendance. So you'll be able to ask questions of FDOT about the LAP program or any questions geared towards FDOT or the TPA staff. And then from there, you'll see all of the projects that are submitted and ranked and prioritized. Those will come before all of the committees in July. So you'll see a draft list of priority projects that'll come before the CAC. And then that list will be finalized and sent to DOT to be included in their work program by way of the list of priority projects that you saw a couple months ago. And that's all I have for you for the update for the Local Initiatives and Transportation Alternatives Program. If you have any questions,
feel free. First, is there any public comments on this item?
No, Mr. Chair.
Okay. Are there any committee members that have any comments? If not, we'll move.
See any hands raised.
Okay, thank you. Administrative items. Summary points on September 17th, 2020 Governing Board meeting. There is no staff presentation on this item unless requested by a member. Next, FDOT project scheduling report. Again, there's no staff presentation unless requested. Myron, do you have any requests on this?
Yes, I do have that. Myron raised his hand.
The report is not dated, and I wonder whether this is updated monthly or how do we assess when this current report is?
Jason,
can you ask the question again? It was a little choppy a little bit on my end. Sorry.
This is Comcast. The question, the report itself is not dated. I could not find a date on it. Is it updated monthly? Can we get them to put a date on it? The question is, how current is it?
It should be every month. And I'll see about the date for, you know, we request it and they'll provide it to us. And then it should have a date for each month that something is updated. I'll look into it and see.
So Myron, the date starts on page 3 and then we request and monthly before the committees, before the agendas.
It's the current submission for our committee, right?
Correct.
Okay, thank you.
Yeah.
Okay, any other questions on the FDOT project scheduling report? If not, we'll move to the August 2020 public involvement activity report. Is there any questions or comments about that report? Seeing none, our next CAC meeting is scheduled for December 2nd, 2020. As a reminder, there are no meetings in November. At this time, the TPA intends to conduct our December advisory and board meetings in person, but this may change if the governor extends permission to conduct virtual meetings. Thank you for your patience with us as we conduct this virtual meeting today.
Chair Harvey, I'm sorry, before you adjourn the meeting, I did want to know, and Jason, correct me if I'm wrong, in your liaison report, I think I failed to include when the airport's presentation is coming.
Yes. I didn't include it on the liaison report. I was just going to report on this verbally to you, but I got through all the items and omitted it. So I just wanted to circle back and remind you that in December, from your request last month, that the airport will come and do a presentation on airport activity impacts to from COVID-19. And so we will have a presentation from the airport on their operations and the impacts in December at the CAC. They're also committing to doing a presentation to the TPA board by way of through the director. So the director will be doing a presentation to the TPA board, and then one of his executive staff will come into a presentation for the CAC. So just wanted to follow up with you and let you know that that's in the works, and we'll see that in December.
Okay, so it would be presented to us December 2nd and presented to the board meeting after the presentation. Okay.
Yes.
So the question I have is December, we've had meetings virtually every place, and we've become used to being virtual. And the question even in our community is, what do you do when virtual isn't required because of COVID, but how do you make sure that you continue to get the attendance at meetings that you didn't have before COVID because of virtual? So it's something that we may want to think, you guys may want to think about, that, you know, it's going to be a different world after COVID than it was before. Okay. At this time,
I'm so sorry. I don't know if you want me to address your comments, but also Michelle has her hand raised.
Oh, Michelle.
I was just going to say real quickly, even though some of those restrictions have been relaxed, I think at some point we all just apply some common sense. And, you know, I think those are decisions that we'll have to make month to month. But that's all I wanted to say.
Okay. We lost your last sentence or two, Michelle. Michelle, we lost your last sentence or two. We didn't hear it. Okay. Thanks. All right. No, I'm saying we ought to be thinking about it as we move forward, because virtual has been useful for us, just like we saw with Kevin.
I did want to note for the committee, and for sure for the board, it was a request during our strategic plan for us to provide a virtual experience moving forward for board meetings, but we also are investigating that for our committees, and we're trying to make it as easily accessible as possible. And that's a key item that Melissa is working on right now. So we will make sure we keep everybody up to date on that.
Right, thank you.
You're welcome.
Any other comments? If none, then the meeting is adjourned.